This is the People's Game for June 23rd. There have been many dramatic days in the 2010 World Cup tournament, but for fans of Team USA, long-term fans and all those people who discovered in the 92nd minutes of today's match that they too were Team USA fans, this day was the most dramatic of all. Landon Donovan's goal in added time saved the Americans from elimination, propelled them to the top of the Group C standings, and made the World Cup the talk of the nation, and just possibly, as time will tell, catapulted soccer into the top tier of American sports. We'll talk to Nick Green, who has followed Team USA as close as any journalist in the country, about this exhilarating moment of triumph. We'll also look forward to the second round match against Ghana. And then, Fernando Romero, a lifelong fan of Mexico and Holland, confesses a newfound allegiance to those damned Yankees. We then move on to many foreign shores. First up, we talk to Graham Beasley about that little team from Oceania, the underdog of underdogs, New Zealand. Lars Eriksson in Copenhagen reports on Denmark's enthusiasm in advance of their showdown with Japan. And Sean Carroll, researching a book on Japanese soccer, lets us know how important tomorrow's match is to the people of Japan and to the future of football in Japan. Then we go to Ghana, and we talk to Gamelli Adzahu about both the national soccer team and the Keita Sandlanders, a remarkable football club in Ghana. At the end of the show, we'll play the entirety of the special broadcast we recorded earlier today, immediately following the USA's stunning victory. All that and more on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined now by Nick Green, he of the great blog 100% Soccer, also a reporter for the Daily Breeze. Nick Green, welcome back to The People's Game.
Always good to be here, Alan.
Well, Nick, what can I say? You, I believe, are the journalist who covers the U.S. men's team as well, if not better, than any other journalist in the United States. I just want to know what you were thinking about 91 minutes into that match today.
Yeah, I was thinking this could be the most important result in the modern history of the men's soccer program in this country, or it could be another massive deflation that the general public would look at this and go, wow, the U.S. was robbed for a second time. Is that what soccer all about? Fortunately, it was the former and not the latter, and we saw history being made today.
I was at the Fox and Hounds near Universal City, Los Angeles. It's a British pub. There was a room which had the British game on a big screen, and then in the other rooms they had both games on. And by that point, next to the big screen were other screens that, of course, showed the USA match next to the British match. When the goal scored, the place, I think it actually lifted off the ground. The whole pub lifted off the ground. I mean, people were jumping up and down. Everybody just went thoroughly berserk. Where'd you watch the game today, Nick?
I watched it at home on my big screen television, but I heard a similar story from the folks at Alpine Village, where I ended up to watch the Germany game later on this morning, and they went pretty insane too. I think soccer fans certainly recognize the significance of this, the tantalizing possibilities of moving on even further, given that the next opponent is Ghana, who the U.S. certainly would like to seek revenge over from the 2006 encounter with them. And then knowing who awaits after Ghana, Uruguay and South Korea, both potentially beatable opponents. So I think a lot of soccer fans are going to be going to bed tonight dreaming very grandiose, but perhaps realistic dreams.
I look at Ghana, and I see a very coherent side with a lot of players who are strong on the ball. They know each other well, but you see them as vulnerable to USA?
Well, I think if you had a choice of who you would like to face coming out of that group, you would prefer to meet Ghana over Germany. So in that respect, I think that the U.S. has a better chance of beating Ghana than Germany. The Germans did exactly what you would expect them to do, and will sort of steamroll forward and setting up an absolutely classic encounter again with England. So that's a really tantalizing clash. But I think that the U.S. just does stand a better chance against Ghana than the clockwork disciplined like Germans.
Before talking about Landon Donovan and his greatness, because I want to return to that subject again just one more time while we have such an opportunity for it, let's look at the USA performance. Who did you think played well? What did you think of the general overall strategy? Who looked weak in your estimation?
Well, Bob Bradley's starting lineup was certainly very interesting. It took a bit of guts to leave Gooch on Weyu out of defense for the first time in this competition, and I think that was probably the right move. He looked winded and not fully match fit in the other games. I think that was a very good move. I think a lot of people were surprised that Hercules Gomez started up front instead of Edson Buttle. Edson Buttle, the kind of player who needs to get into the rhythm of a game, and Gomez, of course, has a reputation in Mexico last season for coming off the bench and scoring goals. So I think people were very surprised in that respect. Maurice Seydoux was a good addition to the midfield, it turned out, because I think he was a very stabilizing force, and that's exactly what the U.S. needed. So I think in those terms, Bob Bradley surprised a few people, and I know a lot of observers have been sort of critical about his conservative lineup selections. We may not have agreed with them today, and I would rather have seen Buttle than Gomez starting, but at least you can't really argue with them, not with the end result.
The final play, I mean, people may not remember, but Algeria had one of their best chances to score moments before Tim Howard began the break that led to the goal. I mean, what presence on the field for a goaltender? I thought that was exceptional.
Well, the entire play was exceptional. I think this is the appropriate point in this conversation to also talk about Landon Donovan. I mean, this is the most complete player America has ever had. And today he followed through, as Clint Dempsey was denied initially by the goalkeeper, to follow through and score that goal and score it emphatically and make a statement. And you could tell that he's been leading up to this for years. He was clearly overcome afterwards, and who can blame him? I mean, that was just a wonderful, wonderful moment for the U.S. attack, period. The fluidity that you talked about, starting from one end of the field to the other, it says a lot about the U.S. And the manner of that victory, the way the Americans never gave up, never, ever gave up. And it was reminiscent of so many games in the CONCACAF qualifying where they've been forced to come back late on, that it just showed the Americans' resilience, and it was just a heart-stopping performance all around.
You actually wrote today in something I posted that this team has established itself as one of the most resilient sports teams in recent memory in any sport. I mean, the way they've come back now in three matches in the World Cup, and of course doing this with, you know, the whole weight of everything they've worked for years about to come down in their shoulder. They stuck to it, and wow, what a moment.
I agree with you, Alan. It's one thing to qualify for the World Cup for the first time in 40 years, as they did in 1990. It's another thing to play like they did in the World Cup today, with the odds stacked against them for the second consecutive game on what would have been a terrible, terrible call to be denied like that, and yet the Americans come through. And the importance of that, I think, for us soccer fans who want to see the sport become bigger in this country, is that the general public, the general sports fan in America is going to take notice of stuff like this, and the game on Saturday should be incredible.
Yeah, what was your sense from where you sit of the response around the country? From where I was all day, it was all anybody was speaking about, and it was all over the media all day long.
Yeah, I mean, you really get that feeling, don't you? I mean, it's about time that this sport came through in the mainstream a little bit. There were so many people wandering around with the colors of this country and huge smiles on their faces. It's certainly different than any other World Cup day I've ever experienced in this country.
And for those of you who are political progressives or radical leftists or leftists of any stripe who turn to the people's game to hear a radio broadcast that you feel allied with, just remember this. This really gets under Glenn Beck's skin. Nick Green, it's always a pleasure. Your analysis is just has so much dimension to it when it comes to this side, and it is going to be incredible these next few days with the build-up to the match against Ghana, and we'll have you back on the People's Game.
Sounds great. Always a pleasure, Alan. Take care.
We're speaking with Nick Green right there, and now we're joined by Fernando Romero, producer of The People's Game, and I'm just asking, Fernando, where were you when Landon Donovan scored the goal, and what did you think?
I was at home. I was beside myself. I honestly, scripts like these cannot be written anywhere, and I was just screaming at the top of my lungs. I could not believe it. That goal, that score by Donovan at the end of the game, at minute 92, was just unbelievable, specifically because it was on a counterattack by the Algerian team. They had like a minute left in injury time, and Algeria had the ball on the opposite side, on the American side. They crossed it into the small box. They couldn't bury it. And next thing you know, Tim Howard gets the ball out, across the field, and they're running, and they're running. And Donovan's like, passes the ball into the box, takes a shot. There's a ricochet. Donovan buries it. And I was just like screaming like a madman. I could not believe it. And one thing that really impressed me specifically about this game was, Michael Bradley. Mm-hmm. Throughout the game, I was just kept my eye on him because I was really impressed by him. Just, he's like an all-terrain vehicle, just running up and down. And people and cynics would say that because he's the son of the coach, mm-hmm. that he's part of this team.
Not at all, yeah.
He embodies the soul of this American team because he was just never stopping. I mean, he was playing a position. He usually plays more of a stopper, like a defensive midfield. But today I saw him, you know, taking free kicks, running up and down each side of every part of the field. So I was really just impressed by, especially by Michael Bradley, overall by the team. Donovan, obviously creative mind of the team.
So you are a Mexico fan and a Dutch fan, but it seems that the United States team is this the first time this has ever happened where they've won your support?
I honestly don't remember like being so exhilarated about an American, you know, triumph any part of the stage. Specifically, you know, Mexico plays U.S. in qualifiers from time to time, so there's that, you know, that rivalry. But today I was really, I mean, because they deserved it because, you know, that game against Slovenia, a goal was taken away, and even in this game they'll get a goal. So I mean, just because of that and this relentless attitude that they had, they deserved just to have that goal in this very dramatic way and to move on with and have that momentum and have the whole country have this, the whole country. It seems as I was looking on Twitter and Facebook, stuff like that, and it seems like everybody was talking about it. Just so incredible.
What is interesting too about this team, which I think has also put themselves forward with a great amount of humility, there's not really any like American arrogance about this particular mm-hmm. side. Well, now they have to face Ghana. And I remember when South Africa, we were all getting ready for South Africa, Mexico, the first match. And, you know, we joked around here that Mexico were sort of the global bad guys outside mm-hmm. of, you know, this region we live in. I call it Greater Mexico, right? No one was rooting for Mexico's. Everybody was just rooting for South Africa. Nothing against Mexico, rooting for South Africa, first World Cup game on African soil. And now USA plays Ghana. And it's going to be interesting because I do think there'll be some awareness building in the next 4 days that the rest of the world, yeah, happy maybe with the way USA did, incredibly dramatic, but interesting to see how many mm-hmm. people around the world carry forward and feel good about a victory by the USA when they're facing the last African side standing. Again, Ivory Coast has a very much a long shot to qualify, so in all likelihood, Ghana will be the only African side to make it through to the second round.
Most likely. People have this perspective of the United States being of this imperialistic power, and because Ghana is this tiny little country in West Africa, I'm assuming a lot of people throughout the world will be, you know, backing Ghana for Sunday's game.
Yeah, it'll be very interesting to watch. And again, thank you so much, Fernando Romero, for joining us on The People's Game. This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Graham Beasley. Graham Beasley writes for www.sportsfreak.co.nz, and that should tip off the fact that we'll be talking to Graham Beasley about the New Zealand side in this year's World Cup, one of the pleasant surprises of the tournament so far. Graham Beasley is a New Zealand native, born and bred, and of course a partisan of the All Whites. Graham Beasley, welcome to The People's Game.
Thanks very much, Alan.
Well, first off, how have things been in New Zealand around this side? I mean, they qualified. They really weren't expected to qualify because they were in a group that had to go through a special game to qualify after they won their region. It was an upset that they got through that match. Now they're there, and they're very much alive in the tournament with two very dramatic draws, including one against the world champion Italians. What's it been like in New Zealand throughout the tournament?
The last 8 months have just been very odd indeed. I think we're all sore from pinching ourselves so much. As you say, we took a strange route to the World Cup in the first place. We had to beat the mites of American Samoa, Fiji and Vanuatu to win the Oceania Confederation, which might be slightly overstating the word there. And then we got drawn in a home and away playoff against Bahrain, who were fifth in the Asian qualifying group. And really the main thing counting against us at that stage is that we just don't play international football. unlike all the other countries in the world, you have your Africans Cup and your Asians Cup and your CONCACAF Cup and all those sorts of things. Because we are the only big fish, comparatively, in an extremely small-sized pond, we just don't get that practice. So we suddenly sort of cobbled together a side at the end of last year, pretty much based around Ryan Nelson, who's the captain of Blackburn Rovers. We went to Bahrain and just sort of parked the bus in front of the goal there and got a nil-all draw, came back here to Wellington and beat them 1-0, which was an upset. And that produced sort of howls and cries from, particularly from Europe, sort of looking at us and saying, how does a side like New Zealand, who's only played 8 games, 6 of them were against very weak teams, how do they get in the World Cup, where, of course, Ireland, for example, missed out?
Russia.
And so there was all sorts of sneering. The only thing slightly in our favour is that we had, at that stage, a slightly higher FIFA ranking than South Africa themselves. So you could argue, well, if you're going to point the finger at anyone, how about the hosts? It's a very strange sort of feeling there that we got to the World Cup. We hadn't played that many games. But even then, the feeling was that when we did get to South Africa, we would get a bit of a hammering. We then went and played some friendlies over the last month and really surprised everybody by beating Serbia in a friendly about 3 weeks ago, 1-0. And at that stage, people suddenly thought, whoa, we've got a chance. But, you know, it was only a friendly and how are we going to go? And so we've just been pinching ourselves, really, for the last few weeks. Got to the first game against the Slovaks, held our own in the first half, went a goal down early in the second, and then got that equaliser in sort of, you know, the 94th minute.
Right.
And the country's just gone mad.
Okay, let's set this up even further. Okay, the one sports side that I think is really renowned around the world are the All Blacks rugby side from New Zealand, very famous rugby side. Is rugby the prohibitive sort of prohibitively the most popular sport in New Zealand?
Historically, it has been. But even before the surge, over about the last 5 years, football is now the most played sport by school children. But they tend to drop off a little bit once they leave school. And certainly from a spectator point of view, rugby is still very much the main sport. But it is all changing now. Whether this can be kept on in the long term, I wouldn't be too sure. But at the moment, the country is just going wild. We've got an all-white day today because the team is called the All-Whites, although in fact they're actually playing in black against Paraguay. But so everybody at work today is wearing white as a show of support for the team, which is a great idea, except, of course, we're in the middle of winter here. And wearing white clothes in winter sort of seems a bit odd and cold.
Well, right now in the tournament, South American teams, I believe, have played 12 matches. They've won 10 and only drawn 2. So it really might not be so much Ireland or Russia that should be upset about not qualifying for the tournament, but really Ecuador and Colombia and the teams that were 6th and 7th in South American qualifying. So while it's true you tied the world champions, who, like a lot of the stronger European teams, seem to be in crisis, and as an Azzurri fan, traditionally I'm an Azzurri fan, it's to take nothing away from New Zealand's accomplishment. It is unbelievable because Italy has a way of really – and what Lippi, the coach, I do believe is trying to do with the team he selected is to try to avoid what happened with France internally by having, you know, no dissension, so leaving out a lot of the top national players because he wants this cohesive side. So there was a logic to what he was doing, and New Zealand stepped up and played a brilliant match. But Paraguay are rock solid. South America has yet to lose a match. This is a daunting task in front of New Zealand tomorrow.
It is, really. And I actually thought in the Paraguay-Azzurri game, I thought Paraguay, if anything, possibly deserved to win that.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have the element of surprise anymore, unfortunately. And I certainly think that got us against Slovakia. I think that once they got a goal up, they thought they had the game won there. And, like, for example, the young winger, in fact, the son of the coach, Weiss, was taken off with about 10 minutes to go, and you sort of got the feeling that maybe the coach was scared he might get injured rather than anything else. So I think the element of surprise was there. The element of surprise was certainly there with Italy. And getting that goal, I mean, in the game against Italy, we scored after 7 minutes.
Right.
And you could just see from then that Italy were thinking, we just can't believe this is happening, you know. And that's when they started to bring out all the acting and the theatrics and all that sort of stuff, which was great to see. Because, I mean, really, they played us the ultimate compliment by behaving like that.
Mm.
Normally they save all that sort of stuff for the big games, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's a great source of national pride in Italy, the manner in which we're utterly loathed by everybody as we collect a lot of trophies.
It's a true skill, isn't it? Yes.
And then
you could just see in the second half in that game they were getting so frustrated and they were starting to take shots from outside the area and the like, and the hands were going through the hair and all the rest of it. And yeah, you could just tell that they were thinking, with 20 minutes to go, we don't expect to be in this position.
Well, we
haven't got that element of surprise with Paraguay.
Well, it's an amazing thing. There's no national sort of top-level club league, right? The top team plays in the Australian League, right? And there's one player who plays in the Premiership, the club captain, Nelson, a few players who play in England in the lower divisions. And what will happen in New Zealand if they win or even just advance? No, can they advance by tying? They can on goal differential.
If the Italy-Slovak game is also a draw, and
right.
Our draw is a higher-scoring draw than theirs.
So what will happen in New Zealand? In New Zealand, if they go through tomorrow,
well, people are talking about a public holiday. and in fact, I think if we do get to the round of 16, the game will be on Tuesday our time, and I think there's even talk about having at least Tuesday morning off for the country. I mean, that is how mad, if you like, the country's gone, really.
Well, now and I believe the way FIFA sort of works is this should secure Oceania the same kind of structure next time around, right? They'll still just have to qualify against the fifth because you guys are making such a good showing. So
there's even the possibility that Oceania might join up with Asia earlier on than it did in the qualifying process. So once we've beaten Tahiti and American Samoa, then we would actually join up with the Asian group at that stage. So we'd do more than just play the home and away. So that would, if you like, become sort of a super confederation where the top five sides would go through from there. And that's certainly what New Zealand would like, because it would mean all the extra games at that level for our players. Obviously, it would mean all those extra games at home, which means money, and it would really give the sport a boost. So rather than a qualifying campaign, which essentially lasted for about a week for us with the home and away against Bahrain, it would be a campaign over about 8 or 9 months.
Well,
and that would really give the sport a huge boost.
Here's a little tip from Hollywood, California, to you, Graham, which is that if they go through right this round, start taking copious notes, and if they go further, get that script ready because there'll be a movie made about this team if they go any deeper than the quarterfinals. So
I think that's true. A thing I've really been amazed about on Twitter in particular is that everybody from around the world keeps on saying. I mean, I don't know if they're saying it to everybody, but they keep on saying to me, "We are you are our second side." And that's from all over the world, from, you know, French people and things like that.
Well, French people, I think you were the first side a few weeks ago, but go ahead.
True. So, you know, people really do seem to be following us. And obviously the draw against Italy has boosted that. And there was a nice touch at the end of that game, of the game against Italy. I mean, you're talking about where our players come from and the club sides. At the end of that game, we brought on a guy called Andy Barron. You know, to play Italy, which is probably the most expensive side in the tournament. Andy Barron is a bank teller. He plays football on the weekends.
He
came on for the last couple of minutes there.
He's going to score the goal in the final. It's almost guaranteed, believe me. I'm in Hollywood. You know, I can assure you of these things. Graham.
Well, we'd actually make the film here with Peter Jackson anyway.
There we go. Yeah. Yeah. Well, globalization is probably a little lower pay rate probably than right here in Southern California. Graham Beasley, it's a pleasure speaking with you. Enjoy tomorrow. It's going to be a lot of fun. Paraguay is a really tough side. It seems the world will be rooting for the All Whites, and I'm certain it sounds like every last soul in New Zealand will be as well. www.sportsfreak.co.nz, and thank you for joining us on The People's Game.
Thank you very much.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm speaking with Lars Eriksen, a freelance writer for The Guardian. He is a Danish national, and he is a partisan of the Danish national side, and we're going to talk to him about Denmark and their chances against Japan tomorrow. But first off, I talked with Lars a few moments ago, and he told me that he watched the USA-English matches in a bar in Copenhagen, and people were chanting USA about a soccer match?
Yes, I was in the Kennedy's Irish pub here in the middle of Copenhagen, and we were watching the England game, but just as people were celebrating the England win, everybody sort of, there was a crowd in the corner who sort of started out with a USA, USA chant, so we knew that something was happening, and little did you know, all of a sudden the DJ start playing the entire Bruce Springsteen collection, so we knew that USA had won. So, that was terrific. I think it's fair play to the U.S. They just had to go through. Absolutely brilliant for them.
Well, let's now look at the Danish team. Odd days in global soccer when the USA has got followers around the globe. But that was a very dramatic win, of course, and probably, again, as we're saying throughout the day here, largest victory in the history of the U.S. men's World Cup soccer team. The whole country here is paying attention like never before, and they always pay attention to the Danish national side that's had incredible... Incredible runs in the 1990s. They had a solid team, and most famously, they won the European Championship in the 90s. This year's Denmark team, first off, Lars, what do you make of them?
Well, it's a funny story, because I tell you what, before the World Cup, there was a sort of slight sense of apathy here, because the team wasn't that great. We all, you know, everybody knew that. I mean, it's only a fourth World Cup, and obviously the glory days for us were actually in the 80s when we... went to Mexico in 86 for the first time with a brilliant squad of players who were potentially at the time some of the best players in Europe. This time around, the hopes weren't high, and after the first games in Holland, it didn't really confirm, it only confirmed their worst beliefs, and 50 minutes into the Cameroon game, you know, the obituaries were already being written about this team, but then little do you know, all of a sudden, our strongest suit, the defense, became shambolic, which made for a very dramatic game, but also it showed some attacking prowess, which was very, exciting. And nobody expected a player like Dennis Romedahl, the guy on the right winger, to produce such a fantastic game. So all of a sudden, there's a sense of belief now that against Japan, that this just could happen. And who knows, with the way that the World Cup is turning out, potentially you get Paraguay in the next game and we're on a run. So, there's certainly a bit of excitement here in Denmark again now.
When I was a kid, Allan Zeemansen, I think, was European Footballer of the Year. And,
1977.
There's no Allan Zeemansen that's sitting on the bench that's going to get pulled out of the coach's back pocket.
Unfortunately not. I mean, there's one exciting player that I've been sort of raving about, which is an 18-year-old kid called Christian Eriksen who plays for Ajax. I mean, you'd say in a World Cup it's quite brutal to put an 18-year-old in the thick of it, but and so far he's only played a peripheral role, but he is potentially, you know, the next type of Allan Zeemansen player that we got. Because if you look at the squad, I mean, it's a bunch of really experienced professionals who, between them, I mean, there's sort of the five players who I think got about 450 internationals between them. Players like Christian Paulsen, Martin Jorgensen, Jondell Thomason up front. And there's been sort of a sense that maybe they are past their prime. But as I said before, against Cameroon, they showed that they've still got some guts. So, I think Morten Olsen for the next game will go with the experience and reckon that's what's going to take us through.
Well, they are in a situation where taking second in their group would place them in a second round match against a group which has Paraguay and Italy. And there could be speculation that the second place team in the group could go past that team. So this is a big game for Denmark. How do you think they match up against Japan?
Well, I mean, there's been a lot of talk here in the Danish media about how strong the Danish team is compared with the Japanese, and especially sort of the height of the attacking players like Nicholas Bentner is obviously a bit of a force. But I think what I've seen from Japan so far is that they've been really solid as well. They had Tanaka in defense, who looks a very strong central defender. So I think it's maybe, I think some of the Japanese media have been overplaying the power of the Danish center forwards. I think as Jondell Thomason said today, we might be for a very boring game tomorrow. which is not necessarily a bad thing if we go through here in Denmark, but I can see it becoming a really sort of hard test, which is actually how Denmark got through to the World Cup. Because if you look at the qualifiers,
tough group.
We had impressive results against Portugal, against Sweden, but they weren't built on necessarily the most, you know, flourishing attacking play. They were down to grit and determination, and I think this is what's going to pull this team through.
See, I actually think quite a bit of Bentner. I think he's a bit of a – doesn't quite fit into Arsene Wenger's Arsenal side. I think he's a force. You know, he's a person you can throw the ball up to. He's a threat in the air. But he doesn't quite fit in the, you know, the tight passing game. And I know a lot of Arsenal fans tend to not think too highly of Bentner, but I always feel that he's a dangerous force on a soccer field. Yeah, he might miss three or four opportunities, but he'll have five or six in a game. So, you know, in a sense, I feel a little bit differently about the Danish team with him up front. I think they do have some potency.
I think they do. And what you have to think about Bentner, he's got an amazing confidence that you'd rarely see from any other Danish players, that he believes absolutely 100% in his abilities. And I guess, you know, he did show that against Cameroon, that you give him a chance and he will score goals. The slight problem we had against Cameroon is that a player like Yondell Thomason, who obviously he's very good at holding up the ball and he probably is the right player to play, but he did miss two glorious chances to give us that extra goal, which mathematically would have made us go through if we do get a draw against Japan tomorrow. Now we need to win this game to go through.
Right. Japan has the goal differential. Now, it is the first match in the third set of first-round games in which the world will not be trying to pay attention to two screens simultaneously. The other two teams, one's eliminated in the group and the other has gone through. So Denmark and Japan, they do take center stage tomorrow. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Danish fans. You know, one of the things we're here in the United States, we don't know all that much about Scandinavia. You know, the right wing tends to group it up there, social democracy. I know that that hasn't exactly been the recent history of Danish politics, where the center right, with ties to the American Enterprise Institute, got into power in the early after the year 2000. In fact, just shortly after 2001, and in fact, anti-immigrant sentiment was part of what propelled them to that electoral victory. But again, one of the paradoxes is, you know, we hear about Sweden and everybody up there is committing suicide, and then they say Denmark's the most happy country in the world. It doesn't sound like they're having happy, happy, joy, joy, embracing this national side this time.
Well, I mean, it's funny when you pull out that statistic about us being the happiest people in the world. I mean, that's, you know, statistics are exactly for that. They'll make for good headlines. I think when it comes to football, again, you were talking before about Alan Simmons and the 70s, 80s team. Up until about the mid-80s, football wasn't really... It was an amateur sport in Denmark up until about 79, when Hummel, one of the big... sporting good companies came in and sponsored, Carlsberg, the beer company, came in and sponsored the team. Up until then, we were pretty much an amateur team. What happened in the early 80s with the introduction of Sepp Piontek, the German manager, is all of a sudden Danes really got behind this team, and it became much more of just something for, you know, it wasn't just for the working classes. All of a sudden, everybody sort of backed football as being a national sport, because of the results, obviously, the game and the pitch, but also because of the whole supporters around it. I mean, there was an infamous game in 1985 where Denmark played a World Cup qualifier against the USSR, which came a week after the tragedy at Heysel, and that sort of gave birth to a whole new meaning of supporters. The Danish supporters became known as the Roligans. Rolig is a Danish word for calm, and it was sort of a reaction to what was happening around, especially on club football in Europe at the time, and it was essentially born out of the carnival movement here in Copenhagen. So it's very colorful. It's about having a good day out. And I think that tradition has carried through. And that is why the fans are really, you know, they're true to that tradition of supporting the team out of a sort of a goodwill towards sports. So I think that they're admirable supporters, the Danish supporters.
Can I ask you a little bit then about Danish society, culture, politics right now? Because again, the one thing that does grab headlines around the world about Denmark are cartoons of the Prophet and such in recent years. Now, that doesn't strike certainly most progressive people as, you know, embracing a global spectacle for the good of the game. It's a little bit more on the nativist reactionary tip. So, you know, how does the World Cup play politically right now in Denmark? And you know, how is Denmark looking right now politically? Is it committed to social democracy, one? And two, is there, on the opposite end of things, is there a strong right-wing nativist movement?
I think without giving too much of a political politician's answer to this one, I think you have to be very careful drawing too many conclusions between the current political situation and football in Denmark. They are not necessarily tied together in the pastime that has a general support through, from the crowds. When you do talk about the political situation, as you mentioned, there has been a certain movement towards the right wing, and the Danish Folks People Party has obviously caused a lot of headlines. I did have a bizarre moment the other day when I was YouTubing some of my favorite clips from the 1980s football team, and they got interspersed with the Danish Folk Party propaganda, and I got very upset because it doesn't have any of those connotations. Football is a people sport here, but it doesn't relate in the same way to politics as you would see somewhere in France.
Well, lastly, what do you think for tomorrow? What's your prediction for Denmark versus Japan? Japan's a very cohesive side. They only have a few players who play in the European leagues. Mm-hmm. Most of the squad comes from the J League. Denmark has a lot of seasoned veterans from the top European leagues. Yeah. You know, on paper, you look at that, most people would tip Denmark to win the match, but they do need to win. A draw, Japan goes through. What do you think?
Well, exactly. I mean, as you pointed out, I mean, we should, on paper, be able to pull through on our experience. But if I have to summarize the second half of a game that we played against Cameroon, it baffles me because that had nothing to do with any sort of football analytical skills or anything. That was purely down to grit and the amount of defensive errors the Danish team were committing were absolutely infuriating the Danish manager after the game. So I think the key priority is that they need to tighten up in defense. They can't. I mean, now that was two games where they've let in. In the first game, it was an absolute howler from the left back. And then the second game, it was one of our most tested midfielders, Christian Poulsen, who let in the second goal. So Denmark, if they can tighten up in defense and shore up the midfield, I think they've got a very good chance of pulling through. But I wouldn't be expecting a goal thriller tomorrow. It's going to be a tight one, but I'll put my money on Denmark pulling through at the end.
Lars Eriksen is a freelance writer for The Guardian newspaper. Thank you so much for joining us in Copenhagen.
It was a pleasure. And good luck for the U.S. for the rest of the tournament.
Thank you. Good luck to the Danes.
Cheers.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined right now by Sean Carroll, who is in Japan. He is a partisan of the Japanese national team, and he is doing research on a book about Japanese football. Welcome to The People's Game, Sean.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me on.
First off, a little bit about yourself, how you came to be a Japanese partisan in terms of the World Cup.
Well, I visited Japan in 2007 for a holiday and took in a game while I was here. And I was impressed by the supporters. I was impressed by the level of the football I saw. So I made a decision then that I wanted to come back out here and spend a bit more time learning about the game and about what it meant to the people here. So last May, so just over a year ago, I moved over here and spent the last year traveling around the country, speaking to players, coaches, fans, anybody with any interest in the game, to find out what the game means to people here.
Japan, the major league is called the J League. How do you assess the quality of that league versus the Western European leagues?
I would say, well, I mean, my best place to compare would be with England. And I would say it's probably the better teams are probably high level championship, so the second division in England, and the worst teams may be kind of League One. So the third level in England.
So the very top club side, maybe the team's relegated in from the Premiership at best.
Yes, I would say so at the moment.
And how much of the national side is drawn from the J League?
The national side is almost everybody. I think they've got four players: Honda, who's in Russia at Moscow; Morimoto, who's in Italy at Catania; Matsui is in France. And there's one more who escapes me now.
Well, if you use that then as the index of a side's quality, one would expect then that they would be underdogs against Denmark. Is that how you see it, or do you think the team, in a sense, the whole is greater than the individual parts?
Yeah, I think there's a lot to that. I think certainly before the tournament, I looked at the group, and a lot of my friends from England and outside of Japan thought they would have no chance of getting through, as did many people here. But the coach actually gave a press conference that I attended just before Christmas, and he spoke about this. He spoke about a lot of the best teams in the world have lots of very talented players, but maybe they don't gel together as a team. And what Japan tends to have is this ability to work together. And certainly the win against Cameroon has given them that confidence and that belief that they can. And they also performed well against Holland. They went down 1-0, and they were a little bit unlucky, I think.
The team only has to draw to go through, so they have goal difference on Denmark. What are your expectations for the match against Denmark?
My expectations are for a very tense game. I think if Denmark score early on, within the first 15, 20 minutes, then it could be curtains for Japan, because they don't tend to create a great deal of chances when going forward. And the ones they do create, they're not particularly clinical. But I think if they manage to hold on past the hour mark, then I think they could just about squeeze through. And conversely, I think if they manage to score early, they are very resolute, and they can get behind the ball, and they can keep the ball very well. So I think an early goal could swing it either way.
Three more questions before we go on to the significance of winning this match for Japanese football, and then what it would mean for Japanese culture, society writ large. Why hasn't there been a global football superstar in Japan? My understanding is the sport is exceptionally popular in Japan. Why do you feel like a few players haven't really sort of risen up and become bigger stars on the global stage?
This is actually interesting. I've just been working on an article about this, and many people often suggest it's the size factor. They say the Japanese players are too small, they can't handle the physical aspects. And I think that's nonsense, as do a lot of other people I've spoken to. The main problem seems to be with Japanese players is they lack the mental strength to deal with it. It's a very national league here is only 18 years old, and they look outside at the Premier League, the Italian League, the Spanish League, and they don't actually believe they can compete with them. I think inside they talk a lot about they want to get up here, they want to play in this club or that club in Europe. But when it comes down to it, they don't have the drive or the guts, if you like, to really follow through. I interviewed one member, actually, of the national team a couple of months ago, and I asked him if he wanted to go to Europe, and he said yes. I asked if he'd like to play in the Premier League, and he said yes. But when I said to him, would you like to play for Manchester United, he said, oh, no, I'm not ready for that level yet. And this guy is 22, 23 years old. And in any other country, Manchester United signed a few years ago a couple of Brazilian teenagers, Rafael and Fabio. They signed them at the age of 16, I think. And these players are now fairly regular in the first team at Manchester United. And this showed the difference to me. The Brazilian players have that drive, that self-belief and the confidence to go to the biggest clubs in the world, whereas I think Japanese players tend to experience a lot of self-doubt.
Well, I think the quick entry for a national soccer culture to draw the attention of the world is for their side to go deep into the World Cup. What would advancing through the first round tomorrow and maybe even winning another match and moving on mean to Japanese soccer culture right now in 2010?
It would be absolutely fantastic for the game. As I said, it's got such a short history as a fully professional game. And the professional league, the J-League, was actually created with one of its primary aims was to improve the national team and to increase the popularity of the sport here, because baseball is actually the number one sport. And in the early years, it was huge. Everyone wanted to go and watch the J-League. There was lots of money available. Some of the biggest names, Zico was here, Dunga was here, Gary Lineker was here briefly. And then it kind of petered out. Japan had the economic crisis sort of early 90s. That sort of hit the football in the mid-90s, so the money went. As a result, the supporters stopped going, the interest kind of dropped a little. And then, obviously, the World Cup came here in 2002, and that the interest kind of creeped up again. And at the moment, it's kind of in a bit, not a slump, it's steady. They get nearly, I think the average attendance is just under 20,000 for the top division in the J-League. which is a good turnout, but it's kind of on a level now. And I think if the team were to progress through the group and to possibly get another win, it would really sort of reinvigorate the game here. It would increase interest in the national team, and it might give the players the belief that they can go outside, they can compete with the best players in the world and earn a spot on some of the best clubs.
How popular is the Premiership La Liga in Japan? Is it followed closely?
Oh, crazy popular. It's, for me, it's a bit of a problem, and it does hinder the development of the game here. When I meet people who are interested in football, I always ask them what team they support, and they always fire back Barcelona, Manchester United, Real Madrid. And when I ask them which J-League team, I don't really watch it. Sometimes I watch the national team.
That's not uncommon.
The league is phenomenal.
Not uncommon in the United States. So for the broader society, Japanese society, what would going deep or even just getting through this round mean to how much national news coverage would it get, and how much of a sort of a national unifying and just sort of a glut of national excitement would it create?
Oh, it would be phenomenal. Whenever anybody does well in any kind of sporting event, there was recently the Winter Olympics, and one of the figure skaters was doing well. The curling team did well, and you couldn't turn on the TV without seeing their face. The golfer at the moment, Ishikawa Ryo, is on adverts all over the place. They really fully get behind them, and I think it would demonstrate for Japanese culture as a whole. It would demonstrate to everybody that they are able to compete with the outside world. It's still kind of, because it's an island, it's kind of similar to England in that it's fairly inward looking. And I think to be able to show they can compete with the best countries out there would be a fantastic achievement. And also, similarly to England, it's difficult in Japan because of its past and its history to display too much patriotism, I guess. In America, I know patriotism is very, very popular from my American friends.
It's also very unpopular, too, though.
Is it really?
Well, yeah. I think there's a very, very, very sizable population in the United States who really cringes at it. And it's not just red state, blue state divide, because certainly a lot of Democrats buy into patriotism as well here. But, because of the role of the United States in the world, there's a very, you're talking tens of millions of people who cringe every time they see it, reaction against the Reagan years and the Bush years.
That's interesting. Well, yeah, it's similar here because of Japan's history with the war and their relationship with other countries, with China, with Korea, and events that have gone on. It is difficult for Japanese people to express pride at being Japanese. You don't see many of the Japanese flags flying. The national anthem is always, you sort of have the extreme right, and that's about it. And it's similar in England. You can't be too proud to be English and British. It's always kind of, people are a bit dubious. But when the World Cup is on, that all goes out the window and everybody can get behind the team. So it's good for Japanese people to have football and all sports to be able to exhibit their pride at being Japanese.
Well, Sean Carroll, I want to thank you very much. You are someone researching a book on Japanese football. And do you have a website?
I do, yes. My website is Sakka Nihon, sakkanihon.wordpress.com.
Sean Carroll, thank you so much for joining us on The People's Game.
No problem. Thank you very much.
This is The People's Game. I'm Alan Minsky, and I'm joined on the phone by Gabmeli Adzaho from Ghana, and he is involved with the Keita Sandlanders Football Club in Ghana. And even before we talk about Ghana, obviously a football team that is going to be the focus of intense national attention here in the United States in the next 4 days, Gabmeli, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Keita Sandlanders Football Club, because I find this a very intriguing club.
Yeah, Keita Sandlanders is a football club located in Keita. Keita is one of the historical towns located in the Volta region of Ghana. And Keta Sunlanders is aiming to become what you call the Barcelona of Africa by leveraging on technology as well as local talent in order to grow the potential of young people in Ghana in football. By so doing, we are interested in promoting development in the Keta area. What Keta Sunlanders is trying to do now is that through the power of technology and web, we are also trying to, after creating a successful model and getting Sunlanders into the top tier of football in Ghana, also translating this model to other parts of Africa and the developing world.
It's very fascinating, and I encourage people to go onto Google, and it's Keta, K-E-T-A, Sunlanders, one word as it sounds, Sunlanders, F-C, yes. And it certainly is, again, a very interesting model. And Ghana has advanced. First of all, what was that like today watching the match and with the other match going on simultaneously?
Yeah, one more word about the Sunlanders, Alan.
Mm-hmm.
What's intriguing about the club is that we are trying to leverage on the web to get as much support as possible from people from all nations. So everybody can join our group on Facebook or follow us on Twitter to get updates as well as make donations that will contribute to the growth of the club.
I saw that, and I do encourage people to do that because it just seems like a fantastic organization, and I certainly know from my own firsthand experience what a positive force a well-organized soccer club can be for a community. So, Gamelli, again, getting back to the match today against Germany, that was certainly high drama, and it was drama that was taking place with the Serbia-Australia match and then the Ghana-Germany match. What did you make of Ghana's performance today against Germany?
I think the Black Stars, that's how we, the fans of Ghana, love to call our national team, mm-hmm. performed creditably against the Germans. They played a very, very tactical game that is holding a lot of action in the midfield to prevent the Germans from just coming with their power attacking play and tearing us down. So we played a very tactical game in order to contain the Germans. And Ghana's only lost guard because of that genius kick strike by the German number 8. And I think the Ghanaian team did very well, but then when it comes to attack, it looks like we need to do our work a little bit because IU, Asamoah, and Jan all be seated during the game. So there should be a little bit improvement in attack, but the rest of it is very beautiful. The best exhibition of Ghanaian soccer art history has been so exhibited.
You know, the Ghana in 2006 was the one African side to make it to the group of 16. While it's technically true that the Ivory Coast is not yet eliminated, and it's possible they could score enough goals against North Korea to close down the goal difference with Portugal, they still are relying on Brazil to beat Portugal. So Ivory Coast is almost eliminated. Why do you think that Ghana is having so much more success on the largest stage, the World Cup, than the other African nations?
Yeah, I think Ghana, I mean, historically, politically, let's focus on sports, has always been a leader in Africa. And the country's growth and focus on youth football and coach football is now gradually paying off because the country has been performing excellently in youth soccer competitions. The country has won under 17. Just last year, the country was the first to win under 20 World Cup. The country was also the first in Africa to win a medal in the Olympics. So we focus on youth football. What's happening is that we are getting a very, very rich supply of wonderful soccer talents. And also because of also the technical training, because in the youth football system, there's also a lot of focus on technical training. So we are coming out with very, very brilliant and alert soccer staff. And because of business connections, because Ghana is also prospering in terms of economically compared to the rest of Africa. So because of all these connections, a lot of our football players also get to play in top leagues in Europe, and that sharpens them and also improves their technical awareness. And I think that this is coming back into the national team. So the Ghanaian national team is gradually becoming a force to reckon in the global football world.
Indeed. And for those who don't know also, Ghana, who lost Michael Essien in, and Chelsea did as well for what it's worth, in the African Cup of Nations, Ghana still went on to the finals where they lost to Egypt. Egypt has a tremendous record in the African Cup of Nations. And a lot was made in the media about the loss of Michael Essien, and I'm very proud to say, and I've said this on this radio show, that I thought even in spite of the loss, having watched the African Cup of Nations, I thought that Ghana had a very good chance to get into the second round, and that they were being underestimated by the world simply because this one renowned superstar, Michael Essien, was missing. So how much do you think the absence of Essien does hurt? He certainly is a great player. How much do you think Michael Essien's absence could hurt them moving forward?
Yeah, Michael Essien, if he's present in the team, will always be a more positive force in the team because of his power play in midfield. But I think the boys have performed creditably well. Not yet to get confidence is sky high. So all they have to do is to forget about the fact that Essien is not with them this time and do what they have to do. So I think that falling on their performance in the African Cup of Nations, Michael Essien will not be missed very much actually now, because the guys are very confident and they just have to make do with changes in tactics to be able to do well without Michael Essien.
Before we look at the matchup with the USA, what does it mean? First of all, were there celebrations? Again, it's a peculiar circumstance where Ghana went through but lost the match. Were there celebrations today in Ghana?
Yes, the celebrations still went on anyway. Everybody's excited that Ghana qualified. The Germans' defeat dulled things a bit, but we are also very excited because the Ghanaian fans are actually much more scared of meeting England compared to meeting United States in the runoff system. Because remember, during the last World Cup in Germany, Ghana beat the United States 2-1 to qualify out of their group.
That's right.
Most Ghanaian soccer fans know that it's going to be a much more easier game for them compared to meeting with England. So people are pretty much excited and bracing themselves for the next round of matches.
What does it mean to the people of Ghana to now know that, again, unless Ivory Coast, a miracle occurs and they somehow qualify, that Ghana will be representing Africa in the first World Cup in Africa from here on out?
Yeah, Ghana, the people of Ghana are always ready for challenges like this because Ghana always sees itself as the leader of Africa, the black star,
right,
standing to defend the integrity of the continent. So it's always a very, very honorable task for us to lead our continent. And we are still playing with our Ivorian brothers so that they can also be able to qualify. I think if Ivory Coast should have any chance of qualifying, they would need a little help from Brazil. If only Brazil can push a couple of goals past Portugal. So we are still praying that maybe things can just work in their favor. So I will be two instead of just us. But then we will gladly take on the mantle for the continent and go as far as we can in the tournament.
So, in this country that I'm speaking to you from, the United States, as you probably know, we have, like a few other countries in the world, a sort of unique national sports culture, and football or soccer has not been one of the most popular sports. Today was probably the most euphoric day in the history, at least, of U.S. men's soccer. And this team that won this very dramatic victory today is now in the headlines of the American media in a way that's comparable, not quite there yet, but comparable to other national teams. How do you feel? Now, I do very much believe, with Ghana representing Africa, that people will probably look at the United States like today, well, they had their moment. And I really imagine the whole world is going to be pulling for Ghana. How do you see Ghana matching up against the American team?
Yeah, it would be a mistake writing off the American team, because if you look at the team, they have quality players, they have Clint Dempsey, they have Jesse Altido, you have Landon Donovan, you have Michael Bradley, and all these players, most of them play their trade in Europe, in some of the top leagues in Europe, and as well as in the Major League, which is also growing in prominence in terms of football or soccer. So it would be a mistake writing off United States. United States has a very strong team and always performs well at the World Cup, only that they are not able to get out of groups with top European opposition. So I think it would be more or less be a battle of equals. because although Ghana has had strong records in youth football as well as football tournaments on the African continent, Ghana has not really distinguished itself in the World Cup yet. So would more or less say it's a match of equals, and Ghana has to be very careful against the American opposition.
Well, Gamelli Adzaho, I want to thank you so much for joining us here on the People's Game. And if Ghana goes further in the tournament, we'll certainly try to get in touch with you and bring you back on the show again. It's been a pleasure having you on the People's Game.
Okay, thank you. It's also a very great opportunity for me to appear on your radio station, to be part of your radio program. Both the United States and Ghana all the best. But, of course, I'm rooting for Ghana, and I know Ghana will be going to the next round of the competition.
Then we will speak to you again. And, again, I certainly encourage people to look up Keita Sandlanders FC on Google.com. And thank you so much, Gamelli Adzaho.
And also, we are doing a series of blog posts from an African perspective, so your listeners can also hook on to www.ketasandlanders.blogspot.com to follow the World Cup from an African perspective.
Oh, thank you so much for that. So again, ketasandlanders.blogspot.com to follow the World Cup from an African perspective. And again, thank you so much for joining us here on The People's Game, Gamelli Adzaho.
Thank you very much, Alan.
Thank you. This is the People's Game, and I wasn't alive in 1950, but I'm guessing that that was the most dramatic moment in the history of the U.S. Men's World Cup soccer team. Landon Donovan scoring after the 90th minute to put the United States through to the second round. It was a match that they deserved to win, but they were going down as both a team that tragically was missing opportunities in front of the goal, boy, and almost comically, and then, of course, missing two goals that they should have had, both against Slovenia and earlier in the match against Algeria. Boy, I was in an absolutely packed pub, a British pub in Los Angeles. They're British fans, they're American fans, and everybody literally is jumping up and down like they were. Everybody in there was like a 16-year-old punk doing pogo back in 1977, and people were literally hitting their heads against the fans. No one was decapitated, I'm glad to say. This is Alan Minsky. I'm here with Jennifer Doyle and Pablo Morales. That is at least the first thing off the top of my head. Jennifer, what do you got to say?
Well, I think I spent most of the match on the floor pounding my fists and wailing. That was an incredibly stressful match to watch. I'm afraid that we were getting a glimpse of what the U.S. is missing, which is a great finisher. I'm getting a little bit impatient with the complaints about the refereeing and goals not being identified as goals because they have offside position, bad calls. They shouldn't be in the position where that matters. I mean, they had so many shots on goal, so many shots that hit the post or went right at the goalkeeper, opportunities which, you know, just like a 5% more something, right, would actually be converting. So I was really frustrated because, it was that glimpse of potential not being quite realized. I'm incredibly grateful to Landon Donovan for securing the win because, really, the U.S. seemed to be the much more creative and attacking side in the game. They were doing brilliantly, but Algeria seemed to have a great defensive read on them nevertheless. And then Algeria seemed to be playing a fairly predictable kind of game. You could see their attacks coming miles away, and yet the U.S. didn't seem to be properly covering them. It was a harrowing game to watch. So don't let that win fool you into thinking that somehow this was a tremendous performance and a perfectly deserved victory. I'm not going to complain too much about the U.S. because, again, I think we did really well. But it was by no means evident that we were going to get that win, obviously, right? It was secured at the very last, most desperate moment. Thank God.
Yeah, no, Josie Altidore is a strong presence up front, holds the ball well, has great moves running at the goal. One goal for Hull this season in the Premiership. So the actual last moment is missing. Pablo Morales, a filmmaker, gringos at the gate. I got to frame it this way again. I think the gringos just, they got the key. They opened the door. They're through the gate. They're in the castle.
Well, that would be really nice. I have to say I didn't see it quite as negatively as Jennifer Doyle, maybe because of the many decades of watching the United States and feeling that, yeah, I mean, half my attention was on the England screen, hoping that Slovenia manages to get that tie, because even though there are so many elements to the American game that haven't fully blossomed, we just don't have that pool of players that are at the top level yet. And that's understandable. We started this marathon of world soccer 20 years behind everybody else. Okay, we're so catching up, it's comical at times.
Yeah.
Now, that being said, luck has played a big part of this tournament and every World Cup.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with getting lucky, considering how many times we haven't been.
Yeah.
So, I also was expecting actually to see a 0-0 tie at late into the game, because I just haven't seen, I just didn't think we had that luck today.
I should say too, I know I'm being a little bit harsh, especially when the parallel game featured England, a side which does have players of that ability, right, and whom we should be expecting to sort of knock away goal after goal confidently and with the assurance that we see throughout the year as they play for their clubs, and they have been absolutely dismal. My comments should be read in sort of the context, a larger context.
Well, two things. First of all, USA won the group, by the way.
Yeah.
So if Germany, in the betting odds, are they're going to probably eliminate Ghana later today, but we'll see. Ghana has obviously so much emotion behind this themselves and this match being really the best hope for Africa. Now that Algeria is out, really the only hope for Africa to put a team through to the second round. So we would avoid Germany if Germany wins, and which means we'd either be playing in all likelihood Serbia or Ghana going into the match. I think that would be, you know, betting odds even. So the United States, I think, has established itself as a formidable team, as opposed to, say, if Slovenia had gone through. In no way would they be thought of in the second round as a formidable side. The other thing I want to say is Holland, the Netherlands. Do you know what they were in the 1960s and 50s? One of the doormats of European soccer, okay? Mm-hmm. America, we 20 years behind? Well, 1990, we've qualified for the World Cup. We've been there since. But it was only in the 70s that Holland turned into the factory of total football. And have remained established as such. We've had national sides. You know, Hungary was the greatest thing in the world in the 50s, completely fall off the map. With the talent pool, the youth organized soccer, the culture of sort of underground culture of soccer that now is burgeoning in the cities in the United States with large immigrant populations that are passionate, I think this is a really key moment in terms of the development of a global soccer power.
But you have to go back to the fact that in Holland all those years, they still had only one major sport, which was football.
Right.
And they had one of the great rivalries of all time in Europe, which was, you know, Ajax against Eindhoven. So, I mean, that developed great players in and of itself.
But 12 million people in Holland, 310 million people in the United States, and incredible organized youth soccer.
I'm going to go against the flow here just because, yes, I'm watching the World Cup, and yes, I was rooting for the U.S. Right. However, I just can't put my energies behind rooting for the U.S. to have a top national team in the world, as if that's going to represent the success of our soccer culture on the ground.
Oh, I agree. So, there's a lot there. And I also, believe me, I have incredible ambiguity.
That's a part of the conversations around the World Cup that make me a little bit uneasy, which is that we put all this hope on this one national team as if it's going to solve all of our problems, right? As if they get to the quarterfinals even, that somehow that's going to advance the game here, and that's going to mean more support for, say, migrant communities who play the game on unpermitted fields
absolutely
while being
not,
policed
right, yeah,
aggressively. Like, I actually don't see there being a strong relationship between the two, or a predictable relationship between the two. So,
but all that it is, in my estimation, is wind in the sails of trying to push all of that in a positive direction. For those of us here who love soccer and want it to be a progressive community, one that where class and ethnic barriers are eliminated in the long run, but at least combated in the short term, and to bring this joyous global community and culture into the United States for the people who live here, not for national glory. Again, I've always thought that the paradox of the United States and the World Cup and United States soccer is the World Cup in so many countries is this source of incredible jingoistic nationalism, whereas here, as we see from Glenn Beck's objection to it, right, and Fox News' rejection to it, here it is about internationalism more. You know.
But it's a split community. Makes it more interesting than a lot of the soccer cultures around the world. The United States doesn't have one culture with regards to soccer. And not only that, it is by far the most unique soccer culture, just because of the way it was created within sort of already a post-imperialistic country. I mean, we already ruled everything. There was just one more thing we hadn't done yet. But when you look at how it was formed by immigrant populations within the United States who are always seen as less than, it has a much harder struggle. That's why I am a huge U.S. soccer fan.
And it's also coded as a women's game. I mean, the Fox News,
right,
the Beck, I mean, there's laced through their rants is, you know, it's not only anti-immigrant, anti-intellectual, it's, you know, anti-feminist and homophobic. It's all that stuff is kind of balled up into the way that position on the right, when what they latch onto with soccer, it's associations with all of the wrong people, basically.
But see, this is the thing. My thought, too, is like for all of us, again, who want a positive, progressive soccer culture here in the United States to continue to grow, it's like, okay, this is a moment where we can say game on, and particularly game on for a country with a soccer culture that has a much greater degree of gender parity. And Jennifer can correct me if I'm wrong. Other countries come somewhat close, and I know there's not gender parity. But compared to so many of the great global soccer powers where there was anything but gender parity.
But we don't have gender parity. We have Title IX. We have a legislative mechanism which allows people who support women's sports to fight for resources. So I'd say that's an important way to difference in approaching it, because there's a lot of mythology about there being a near total equality around soccer. Now, I actually think some of the right-wing hysteria around soccer is actually related to Title IX and the kinds of incursions of women's sports on the college level, especially around football programs, which basically make Title IX compliancy almost impossible to meet. So it's like, you know, this is a complex network of stuff. I'm eager to get back to talking about the game itself.
Let's do it.
So, because I want to talk about Dempsey, because I was frustrated because I was, you know, I saw him with opportunities to score and taking shots and then not quite converting. And Pablo's right. A lot of that was bad luck. He had a lot of pluck today, and he could have really lost his head. He took a punch in the face off the ball, and which the referee didn't see. And you could see a cut lip in the last few minutes of the game. He could have easily lost his head. The game could have completely disintegrated around that moment, and it didn't. And those guys get a lot of my respect for that, for holding onto their concentration and not letting those kinds of shenanigans pull their attention away from the ultimate goal.
Yeah, and the guy who got the red card in the end, the captain of Algeria, a very unjust red card in terms of that moment, actually was the guy who smacked Dempsey and should have gotten a red card right then.
Yeah,
I think Dempsey is sort of the prototype of, I hope, what becomes the U.S. style, which is, you know, here he comes from a small town in middle Texas, which doesn't have any soccer culture in terms of the white community at all. He associates himself more with the hip-hop side of his own community. He has a fearlessness, a pluck, a bravado, whatever you want to call it, and he's unafraid. And that shows when he plays for his English club team as well. And I think that actually that spirit was evident against Slovenia when they came back from two down. Also, when he scored the goal against England, I'm terribly impressed with him. I wish he had more luck on his finish today. But
and Jozy Altidore, I mean, on the Twitter feeds, people were strangely impatient with him. But I thought he really pushed forward with the ball. He had some amazing runs where he beat two defenders. I mean, I saw him do that at least twice, if not three times, and either cross the ball in a beautiful way or draw the foul. He had that kind of work that often doesn't really get glorified because he's not making a shot on goal, but he's bringing the ball up the field, kind of completing the impulse of a transition in the game, and doing it with force and conviction and just really great moves with his feet. I was really pleased with his contribution to the game today, in the second half especially.
You know, a lot of people say, well, he only had one goal for Hull. He's, you know, he doesn't really do so much. But if you watch those games against Hull, when he was on the field, Hull was winning the games. He did the little things, take on the defender, body up against. And when he was just a teenager, we have to remember, he went and just cleaned up on the MLS, which many people say, well, that's not much of a league. I think it's one of the top leagues in the Western Hemisphere. I mean, I watch a lot of the Argentine, Brazilian, Mexican league games. And although maybe player for player, it's not to those levels, organizationally, it's tough to be a forward in the MLS and score a lot of goals, and he did as a teenager. I think he has a lot of promise.
I love the moment when Buttle came on the field in his first touch. He just had such composure directing the play. I thought that was a nice moment right there. And then the play that he called for sort of worked. I liked when they attacked the touch line and came in down there. It's actually what produced the goal. And for a while there, they were going too much through the middle, and Algeria was clogging the middle. Obviously a little shaky on defense, especially in the first 25 minutes. Why didn't Gooch play? I'm not sure.
Yeah, no one knows. I just texted somebody who might know the answer. I got nothing. So.
Yeah, other than Gooch being out, I thought Bradley's substitutions, though, were pretty smart. And I like seeing Beasley at the end. You know, that was definitely, okay, this guy means we're going for it. Now we're pulling off a defender and basically putting on an offensive wing player. Bradley, too, in the middle, the coach's son, is a darn steady force for them right now.
They kept their heads today. It was a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see Bradley as the one who's going to come out of this World Cup with a nice, sweet contract to the EPL. I mean, that's my feeling.
I wouldn't be surprised if Buttle gets something, by the way.
Oh, God, we can't lose Donovan and Buttle on the Galaxy. Sorry.
Well, Buttle is really strong, and I haven't seen him enough to really say. And I agree about Altidore. Altidore's got mad skill on the soccer field, and hopefully now, again, you know, I do think in the back of their mind they had that goal taken away against Slovenia. They had the first half that they had in the back of their mind. Terrible performance in the first half against Slovenia. Now they're in clean space, so we really get a chance to see what this team does. And boy, are we going to have, I think, again, for the first time in my life, for nothing like 2002. This is going to be 4 days of intense hype.
What I find scary is that Algeria, as well as they played in certain ways, they were really not great up front.
Right.
So, and the U.S., that the U.S. did not look that great defensively against a team that wasn't really challenging them up front. I find that a little bit scary. There seem to be a lot of pockets and holes today, other teams are not going to let them get away with that.
Well, we're sending this out as a special edition of the People's Game before the regular show broadcast to try to get it around to national media. So we do not know the result yet, who England will face in the next round or the United States will face in the next round. But there could be, if Germany beats Ghana, England versus Germany. England looks so flat. I do want to say this, though. You know, I don't know how many people out there know Fabio Capello, his record as a manager is really unrivaled. It's true he had a talent base that probably surpassed Mourinho, but in his early part of his career, he was the coach of an AC Milan team that has pretty much, for major European competitions, the most incredible unbeaten record. Arsenal, you know, had this great record in the Premiership. AC Milan was in all competitions. You know, that's how great they were. He was the coach. Everywhere he went, he won, except for Real Madrid, and then he sort of ducked out and went into the international game. Too much of the two superstar-laden team of the Ronaldo Beckham era.
He couldn't get that to win.
But he won with Juve, the team that was the core of the Italian World Cup championship in 2006. So I expect more from them when they're facing tougher competition.
Yeah, I think that's part of the story is they need to be inspired.
Yeah, I think that's the problem is that Capello is really expecting them to be professional. You know, calm, cool, collective. But, I mean, how many people, when you play with English players, they are all about emotion. You know, the reason that they developed this game of kick and rush, as was derogatorily said, I think a lot of it is because they just feel like you just got to get up there. You just got to go up and score the goal now to the wing, to the center, score. And that's not how world soccer is played anymore. Look at Spain to see how world soccer or Argentina, you know, control the midfield, control the tempo, control possession.
But I do think if they face Germany, I expect to see that team fall into line, and they'll again recognize the asset they have in Capello. How else could they approach a match against a team with the strength of Germany without, you know, recognizing that, you know, this guy knows what he's doing in terms of managing a soccer team? Maybe not, but I expect that'll happen, especially if they face Germany. Again, enough about England. Lastly, let's go to Pablo first, a filmmaker, Gringos on the Gate. The moment Donovan scores.
If you're a longtime U.S. soccer fan, the goal that supposedly was heard around the world was Paul Caligiuri's goal against Trinidad and Tobago in 1989 that put the U.S. into their first World Cup in the modern era. Guess what? Paul, I like you a lot. You're a great guy. But I think Donovan just surpassed your shot heard around the world. At least a lot more people saw this one on TV.
Well, let's remember, too, that quite a few players touched that ball before Donovan did. So I think that was an incredible shot, but it was also icing on the cake for just a really kind of great group effort in the last few minutes of the game to put it away. It also reminded me of a kind of observation I made a little while ago on my blog that the closest cousin to soccer is basketball. I know no other sport where a really great game is decided by, frequently, very frequently decided by 1 point. 2 points, right? There's just like the only, you know, the difference is, of course, basketball, you know, it's shot, 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 basket, 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 basket. And in soccer, it's just that one. But it has a very similar kind of, to me, drama. And I was reliving some of my past years when I was following NCAA basketball. And that just kind of last minute shot that puts the game away, and that just very specific euphoria to that. And it's not every day in soccer that you get that in the last minute of play. So it was just a great game to watch.
I have absolutely nothing to add except, you know, I've had a very ambivalent relationship to Team USA. Grew up, my side was always the Azzurri. I dreamed of playing for Team USA, and I felt uneasy about the USA doing well in World Cups in the past, or going into it. I didn't care if they did. I was happy when they did in 2002. But by this World Cup, I in being in Los Angeles and seeing the incredible soccer culture that is there, that doesn't get enough attention, that so many people could participate and find joy in, I think this is a moment that helps that all along. I was rooting for him today. And again, I was one of those people at the top of my head hit the fan. Jennifer Doyle from a Left Wing, Pablo Morales, Gringos at the Gate. This is the People's Game. Mark Torres, a lifelong football fan, has watched the USA on the margins of the global game. You're a big Premiership fan. Your side is Liverpool. Your player is Torres, of course. And what does this victory signify for you?
It was absolutely amazing. We came 90 minutes through this match thinking that, you know what, we're going home. I mean, England scored an early goal. It looked like England and Slovenia were going to be pushing through. And really, the United States had so many chances. Dempsey had a wide open shot. I mean, they were just pounding the goal, couldn't get it in, hit the post. Balls were just in the box waiting to be slotted through, couldn't happen. And in the 91st minute, you know, Tim Howard was amazing. There was a shot on goal. He saved it. And does he just, you know, rejoice and hit the ground or something? No, he's aware. And he throws it out to Donovan and starts a 4-on-3 break. That was just classic. And it's huge for American soccer because it's really not the go-to sport. Basketball, baseball, football, those are the glamour sports here in the United States. And for the United States to do that well at a turning point in soccer here in America, it's huge.
Here's my thought for you, my one question for you right now. I think this is a highly, highly important moment in our entry into the global game because now we have a team that moves into the second round. They're not a slight team. In fact, for the sake of the tournament, it's good that it's USA, not Slovenia. Slovenia would be massive underdogs in their first second round match. USA will be a formidable opponent. Here's the thing. Okay, helps the MLS, no doubt. But now, do you think American fans will follow? Probably every one of these guys who's out on the field, at least seven of them, right, are going to get positions at top European sides, at least top of the table, or there'll be stars on the lower of the table of the top four or five leagues in Europe. Don't you think with the globalization of television, of the Premiership, of La Liga, that U.S. fans will start following them?
I think so. The thing is that America has a lot of young players, and we already heard of players going into the Bundesliga. Yeah, I think a few more players will get picked up as well. So that type of experience is invaluable to U.S. soccer. They need to go out into the better leagues in the world to get the experience. And I think that just makes our profile larger on the global level, but also here locally seeing, you know, I've been following our American teammates in the Scottish leagues, in the British Premiership, in the Bundesliga. You know, we're sprinkling throughout. And
yeah, I think in particular, I think Donovan now is going to be followed. I think that is one thing that is now growth.
I keep hearing that Donovan is now, he's hated by the Mexican fans.
Yeah, I think it's more that Mexican fans love to hate Donovan. I don't think it's only actually Mexican fans that love to hate Donovan. There's something about him that provokes a very strong, at least ambivalent, sometimes even negative reaction, though. I have to say today, I mean, I've been warming up to him over the past 18 months, 2 years. I found that his whole role in that Beckham thing made him very intriguing and interesting to me as somebody who seemed to be resisting in a way a kind of a dark side of the MLS. There's something more to that guy than we've seen in the past, and we're getting a glimpse of it now, especially on the heels of his terrific performance for Everton when he was on loan this past season.
But at the same time, Donovan, I think, is conducting himself so professionally in the wake of a goal that was taken away in the last match against Slovenia. I thought he handled himself so professionally. He wasn't screaming at the refs. He wasn't behaving like the ugly American. Conducted himself very well. And here today, another legitimate goal was taken away. And you see nothing but class from Donovan. So I think that is going to help him win fans throughout the world.
Mark Torres there. We heard the voice of Jennifer Doyle with the blog From Left Wing, and now Pablo Morales, filmmaker, Gringos at the Gate.
Yeah, it's interesting because Gustavo Arellano asked me to help answer the question in his column that I hope comes out soon, why Mexicans hate Landon Donovan so much. And there's an actual event that's behind a lot of it, which is in the 2004, I think it was Copa America, they were playing in Guadalajara, and he actually urinated on part of the Chivas field, the Estadio Jalisco. It's
That'll get you hated.
But actually, it's not something. It happened in the early warm-ups. It actually happens fairly often, especially in some of these stadiums.
It's very John Terry.
Yeah, I heard the bathrooms were locked.
Yeah, there was a lot of stories. There was a lot of stories behind that. But the real reason for the hate, in my opinion, what I told Arellano was, throughout the history of the U.S.-Mexico soccer rivalry, yes, there were some American teams that showed a lot of grit, some determination. They would win games through the physicality of the U.S. team. The mental toughness is often attributed to their victories. But never, 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 never is the best player on the field an American.
Yeah. Right.
And that's where I think the hatred really comes from. Because when Donovan won the Golden Boot in the 1999 Under-17 World Cup in New Zealand, he became the first person from the CONCACAF region to win a major World Cup award. And I think that was the beginning of this, oh my God, what is the United States starting to produce?
Yeah.
You know, these players that can shine at the highest level.
His goal today was really, I mean, that's the clutch player, right? The person who can really pull out exactly what's needed at the last minute because it absolutely must happen. I mean, that was the goal. That's what that goal meant today. And it was a really strong finish, just an absolutely fantastic moment. And exactly the kind of thing that the U.S. team has needed for a long time is a player like that, that you can count on. To really pull things together. It was a great win. It was a really great win.
I want to add something about Landon Donovan. I was incredibly impressed in 2006 with a short documentary sort of story feature that I believe ABC or ESPN did in advance of the 2006 World Cup about Landon Donovan. I might get this wrong or the details wrong, but I believe his sister's boyfriend was drunk or something and fell onto the tracks of the metro in Paris and had his leg severed. Okay? Donovan spoke about that. You know, they always sort of search in these little mini documentaries for the, you know, real hurdle that the people have to overcome. Well, okay. But Donovan spoke about this extemporaneously, and I was unbelievably impressed. I know these are very structured to find the most dramatic moment to make a positive impression on the character. But here's a guy I was talking about. Someone, a soccer player, talking about someone losing their legs and counseling the person that your legs, your body, are just there to propel your mind. And I thought it was a really beautiful human expression of dealing with trauma from somebody who, of course, values his legs. I mean, I don't want to, you know, get too analytical on it, but I was so impressed with Landon Donovan, and I saw the person again, albeit some sort of negative side, but speaking his mind, speaking it very intelligently with the whole thing that transpired with Beckham.
Yeah. I think going back to your original idea of what's this going to do in terms of the marketability of the U.S. players, one of the fascinating aspects of world soccer is that you have countries like Argentina and Brazil that export their best players to Europe. And their national sides do not suffer for this export. But I'll be fascinated to see, as the United States players become more visible in foreign leagues, whether the U.S., sense of superiority will think, well, why aren't we the best league in the world? Why aren't they staying home?
Thank you very much, Mark Torres, Jennifer Doyle, and Pablo Morales. This is The People's Game, a special edition after the dramatic U.S. victory over Algeria to win Group C. Our regular show will be available later today at www.thepeoplesgame.org.